This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. President Joe Biden turned his State of the Union speech Thursday night into an animated argument for a second term. In a campaign-style delivery, Biden emphasized what he said are threats facing democracy around the world, calling on Congress to greenlight additional aid to Ukraine in its war against Russia.
Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that needs to defend itself.
Republicans in the House of Representatives are blocking a Senate-approved foreign aid package that includes $61 billion to help Kyiv in its fight against Russia. Biden also lauded the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, which he called the strongest military alliance the world has ever seen. AP Washington correspondent Saga Magani reports Sweden has formally become NATO's newest member.
Sweden has formally become NATO's 32nd member as security concerns in Europe spike over Russia's Ukraine invasion. President Biden notes NATO was formed as a shield against aggression.
Today, we have fortified the shield.
With Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying Sweden's addition makes the alliance bigger and stronger than ever.
Today is a truly historic day.
Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson says after two centuries of non-alignment with major powers and decades of military neutrality, Sweden has taken the next step by protecting both itself and the alliance. He will be a guest of honor at tonight's State of the Union address. Sagar Magani at the White House.
As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Britain says it will provide 10,000 drones to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. We get the details from VOA's Alexis Strope.
Britain says it's providing 10,000 drones to arm Ukraine in its fight against Russia. UK Defense Secretary Grant Shapps made the announcement Thursday during a visit with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv. The investment includes £125 million of new funding on top of £200 million previously committed for drones. The weaponry will include 1,000 one-way attack, or kamikaze drones, and models that target ships. Ukrainian sea drones reportedly sank another Russian warship in the Black Sea this week, the latest in a series of strikes that has crippled Moscow's naval capability. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
In other news, AP correspondent Jackie Quinn now reports that a Texas utility at the U.S. state of Texas, that is admitting a role in sparking the state's worst wildfires that continue to burn.
Utility provider Xcel Energy says its facilities appear to have played a role in igniting a massive wildfire in the Texas panhandle. Xcel Energy is admitting to a role in sparking the largest blaze, but the utility is denying any negligence. One homeowner in Stinnett has already filed suit, saying that Xcel and two other utilities failed to maintain or replace a wooden pole that had snapped off of its base. Last week, Governor Greg Abbott described the destruction of the wildfires that have killed at least three people and destroyed some 500 structures.
Nothing left but ashes on the ground.
Other electric utilities have been found responsible in other fires, including the blaze in Maui and the deadly California campfire in 2018. I'm Jackie Quinn.
DAP's Mike Hibben now reports an U.S. Army soldier is linked to some documents that were leaked.
An Army soldier is accused of selling sensitive military information. Justice Department officials say Corbin Schultz is accused in a six-count indictment on charges that include conspiring to obtain and disclose military defense information and bribery of a public official. Schultz was arrested at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, after the indictment was released Thursday. He's accused of disclosing various documents, photographs, and other national defense materials since June of 2022. Schultz had top-secret security clearance. He allegedly conspired with a foreign national and received at least 14 payments totaling $42,000. I'm Mike Hempen.
And for details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Without naming Donald Trump, But this being an election year, really contrasting himself with Trump and saying that the former president, who's trying to be the next president, is on the wrong side of history. The most, I thought, pointed and critical quote is when he said a former president actually bowed down to a foreign leader, talking about Trump and Biden, calling that dangerous and unacceptable, and that he would never bow down.
He's echoing language that he used a few weeks back when he said basically that Trump's comments, and I'm going to repeat them, that he would not defend countries that were late in their NATO dues in the case of a Russian invasion. He would let Putin do, quote, whatever the hell he wants. He's described those as un-American. And he kind of continued that tonight and said, I will not bow down. He also covered, as we expected, a wide breadth of domestic issues focused on the economy. This didn't seem to impress the man sitting right behind him, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who, unlike the Vice President, who was also seated behind him, remained seated for most of the speech. I believe there were two instances where we noticed that Mike Johnson stood up. One was a reference to civil rights protests in the 60s, and the other was on bringing the Israeli hostages back to the States.
And on the other side of the aisle, led by the Vice President up there, of course, they're taking their cues from her as well. When she stands up, then they all stand up, and that's very common. We see sort of an overreaction from those with the party in power, and if you have a Speaker of the House who's from the opposition party, then they're not really going to demonstrate that they're a cheerleader for the president, especially when we're in a very strong partisan divide in this country.
Now, if we could shift to Israel and what he said about the conflict in Gaza, there was a little bit of news, of course, that we saw today, which is the United States is building a temporary pier to get more aid into Gaza because, of course, these airdrops are both insufficient and also you're literally dropping food on people's heads, which presents a lot of dangers. So he also criticized Israel, or seemingly criticized Israel, for not allowing humanitarian aid in. He took a pretty firm line. We did see Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib hold up a sign that said lasting ceasefire now, presumably in response to Biden's call for an immediate 6-week ceasefire. Did you notice anything else, Steve, that struck you about Israel?
Well, I think he tried to balance it, and it was some of the most blunt criticism we've heard of Israel. He was very explicit about the number of Palestinians, 30,000, that have been killed, the massive damage that has been caused. But there were also in the chamber, and he pointed it out, that there are American families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. And he said, I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home.
He also did say, and this is what Israel says, if you want to stop the war, Hamas, which started the war, should lay down their arms, give up the people that coordinated the attacks on Israel, and return the hostages. It is not an unfair point to make, and one that Israel repeatedly makes, that they were attacked by the government of the Gaza Strip, and they are essentially at war with them, and if they wanted to stop, they should surrender.
But realistically, Hamas is unlikely to agree to any of that except releasing some of the hostages in exchange for many Palestinian prisoners and a pledge from Israel to stop the attacks.
One other thing that struck me in reference to this region was he reiterated his support for a two-state solution, but he added a qualifier. Two-state solution over time. And I'm always a little bit suspicious whenever I hear high-level politicians add qualifiers to things. You know, when you say over time, you know, it kind of softens it a little bit. So he did show a commitment to a two-state solution, but on an indeterminate time scale.
He also made a reference to Saudi Arabia, which I thought was interesting. And that told me about some negotiations that had been going on behind the scenes and that he's hoping will again. And that, you know, what was happening before the Hamas attack was we were on the road to this normalization of ties between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And that would lead to recognition, we're told, of a Palestinian state. So seems like there's some optimism among the president that, you know, we could have a ceasefire and then some more progress towards a lasting peace in the Middle East.
So anyone who's watching the live feed will notice that the president has made it maybe about 10 feet since he stopped talking. He's chit-chatting with people who are on the House floor, and he looks very pleased. And
well, he is taking a celebratory lap around the chamber. He is with his fellow Democrats, chatting it up. He looks good. He looks happy. He looks alert. you know, it's not the kind of thing that you would say normally after a speech like this, but it is the elephant in the room.
Well, he addressed that directly when he said, some of you might have noticed that I'm a little bit old, which is, you know, and what I did also notice vis-a-vis his age was where he said, you know, my opponent or somebody else, I forget how he said it, but he said, other people my age.
Yes, that was reference to Donald Trump and other
and they're 4 years apart in age, which, you know, I believe when you get up to your 70s is probably much of a muchness, right? And he's making that case because, of course, Trump is making the case that Biden is so old and Trump is a sprightly 77.
But you know what they say, Anita, 80 is the new 50.
You're listening to live coverage of the State of the Union Address and the GOP response. This is the Voice of America. We are waiting for that response to come. Normally after the president wraps up the speech and makes his way towards the end exit door of the chamber, we get a live speech from someone the opposite party, in this case the Republican Party, chooses to make their case. In this year, it's going to be Alabama Senator Katie Britt. She is the youngest Republican woman elected to the U.S. Senate. We've seen a bit of her speech. She is going to border is going to probably be her big border and crime, I would assume. And economy are going to be her big points.
Right. I received some of her talking points a little earlier today, and she's going to argue that his policies have rapidly accelerated American decline. This is pretty standard Republican language. What I did find kind of interesting and striking is that early today, and this is a little bit unusual, three prominent Republicans put out what they termed pre-buttals. When the Republican Party had already chosen this youngest woman in the Senate to give a rebuttal, these three gentlemen decided to pre-butt in on her speech, I suppose, and say their piece. And those are, of course, Mitch McConnell, Speaker Johnson, and former President Donald Trump. What I thought was kind of interesting, which remains to be seen, is what she's going to say on the topic of reproductive rights. She is, of course, from the state of Alabama, which recently had that IVF ruling saying that embryos have the same status as babies. But the advanced portions of her speech that they sent us did not include any reference to that, which was kind of notable.
It would be surprising if she ignores that totally. But I think the line from her that's going to get picked up, that's going to be the big soundbite, is she's going to call the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States,
dithering and diminished
leader, yes. And America deserves leaders who recognize that there should be secure borders, stable prices, safe streets, et cetera. So dithering is a particularly harsh word, I think, to throw out there.
I think diminished is also very harsh, considering his age. But what's kind of interesting about the rebuttal, which we are now looking forward to, we're waiting for that to start, is that the person giving the rebuttal is not afforded anywhere near the dignity, the pomp, or the time slot that the president gets. These speeches usually run to about 15 minutes.
And it's pre-recorded without an audience. It's not going to have the oomph of a State of the Union, and it's condensed, and the Republicans will have their opportunity here to take their best shot and get you know, a little bit of airtime on a night and a following day where much of it's going to be devoted to what the president said.
I dare say, like, in this world of, like, Twitter and social media, is this even, and pre-buttles being a thing now, is this even really relevant? I mean, what has Trump been up to today on the internet talking about this speech?
Even there were he's on another social media platform of his own that doesn't have the impact that the former Twitter still has. But at one point he had a jab in the middle, you know, of the speech there when I think Biden started coughing and he said the drugs must be wearing off. Again, trying to also put forward this message that at his age, Joe Biden is not up to the job.
It's, you know, it is the dichotomy of the two sides, one of positivity and one of negativity, which he also addressed in his speech. His vision, his agenda was one of forward motion, one of hope. The Republicans are one of everything is falling apart. It's worse than it ever has been. And to a degree, that's selling, particularly when it comes to the economy. It's so difficult to explain to somebody. Mm-hmm. You can't have low interest rates and no inflation. So, but when you start talking like that, you see people glaze over because all they know is peanut butter is more expensive, their mortgage rates are more expensive.
Yeah, we had you know, you could tell the speech writers were working really hard to bring this down to something that average Americans could relate to. We had references to shrinkflation, less potato chips in the bag, and a shrinking Snickers bar. So
that's truly a bipartisan issue. I think we can all agree that there should be the same number of potato chips in a bag.
That may be one of the few instances of the night where there was bipartisan agreement.
It is still a difficult case to make when in the previous administration interest rates were lower and inflation didn't exist yet. So, you know, you can say all of those things, but if you still have to go to the grocery store.
Yeah, and this is what really, when people go to the polls in November, they'll be thinking about, you know, what am I paying now for the price of eggs, milk, a gallon of gasoline?
Which are literally three things that the President of the United States has zero control over.
I like to tell people that, you know, presidents and their policies might be able to smooth out the edges of what's happening with an economy going up and down. But you know, when they're out of office or running for office, they blame the other person, the other guy. When they're in office, they like to take credit for when things go right.
The White House is very quick to send out releases to us in the press corps whenever the price of petrol goes down. They mark that as I guess, some sort of notable thing that we should ascribe to the White House.
Yeah, and this is it's something very serious here. I believe it was Moody's that put out a report essentially saying that if the price of a gallon of gasoline goes to $4 a gallon, that would likely cause Biden to lose the election, you know, with some other factors. So that's being very closely watched by people in the White House. And there are, you know, there is the National Petroleum Reserve. We don't want to get too wonky. And the president can order releases from the Strategic Reserve. But what we're also seeing, much of it is out of control because Saudi Arabia and Russia, for example, have decided to cut back on production. And that will cause the cost of gasoline.
Speaking of Russia, Steve, let's talk about the Russia reference that maybe the president did not intend to make tonight.
When he said prescription drugs and you fly to Canada or wherever, and he threw in Moscow there, which was not in the script, and tried to recover from that. We'll be seeing that soundbite on the conservative news channels.
He was making the point that prescription drugs are more expensive in the United States than they are pretty much anywhere else in the world, including, as he said, he recovered from that fumble, I guess, and he said even in Moscow, which is possibly true. Prescription drugs in the United States are more expensive than they are almost anywhere else in the world.
Well, I think Democrats and Republicans are also united in agreeing that our health care system is broken in this country, not the quality of the care, but the cost of it and how it's billed and how you pay for it. All of us in this room, I'm sure, can relate to that as well.
Speaking of broken things, immigration. What did you make of the reaction to his words on immigration and on that bill that, Republicans had supported?
He was calling the Republicans out, saying, look, this is what was in this bipartisan bill. Conservative Republicans had agreed to this. And it was going to have more border guards. It was going to do a lot. And it was Donald Trump from the outside that pressured members of Congress to kill this because it would hurt Biden and help Trump in an election year. He was very blunt about that.
I thought from a performance standpoint, those were his finest moments in the speech when he started to get heckled by the Republicans. He engaged them directly, and in this
jocular tone.
Well,
yeah, he tried to make light of it too.
The mood, where we are now politically, where it's more like two rival football teams arguing at the stadium than it is the two political parties running the country. You know, when they engaged him in that, he goaded them. By saying, look, you don't want to pass the bill for more this or more that. It happened several times over the evening on several different issues. I thought it was an extremely effective tool to blunt both his diminished capacity and their...
Right. He's able to think on his feet. He demonstrated that. But we also would not have seen this sort of lack of decorum even, 15, 20 years ago. This is something I think the first time was during an Obama State of the Union where we had a member of Congress say lies or something, and we heard that again tonight. And it was Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is definitely one of the most outspoken members of the right wing in the Republican Party, who was repeatedly heckling him. But you know what? That's not going to hurt them at all with their base. They're going to be seen as being defiant and standing up to a president that they believe is diminished and not putting the country on the right path.
So in terms of what this address tonight is going to accomplish, that's the big question for me. I talked to the pollsters earlier this week, and they said usually after an event like the State of the Union, there is a bump if the president does, deliver. But it's temporary, and it'll wear off.
Yeah,
people are fickle, I guess.
Well, and also, Anita, we well know that most people in this country of voting age are very fixed in their opinions. They're very partisan. But we have a majority of people saying they'd rather see two other people contesting for president from the Republican and Democratic Party. Perhaps there are some independent voters in play, and he could pick up a little bit.
I'm trying to figure out what he said tonight that kind of reached out to the independent or uncommitted voters in these key swing states specifically. I mean, he moderated his language on Israel by really kind of putting center stage the suffering of Palestinians, which was the strategy that the vice president used in Selma last week, kind of centering the Palestinian experience and their suffering. And I was surprised, by the way, that he acknowledged the 30,000 dead figure, because he has previously questioned figures from the Hamas-run Ministry of Health.
Yeah, it was stated as a fact.
Right.
Don't you think that what he did tonight was delineate himself? Again, you know, you're right. There's a lot of issues, right? So if the majority of the country is already siloed where they're going to vote, and you're talking to this very small middle, what he did tonight, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of an election kind of strategy was, again, this is the positive vision of the country. Mm-hmm. We're Americans, he said. We can do anything. You know,
this isn't new from Biden, by the way. I've heard this a million times.
Of course.
Right. Well, you know, another thing you need to do when everybody is in their silos, as you say, Scott, is you need to rally your base to get out on election day. And
let's go
Biden,
to the, if I may, the Republican response.
The American family needs to have a tough conversation, because the truth is we're all worried about the future of our nation. The country we know and love seems to be slipping away, and it feels like the next generation will have fewer opportunities and less freedoms than we did. I worry my own children may not even get a shot at living their American dreams. My American dream allowed me, the daughter of two small business owners from rural Enterprise, Alabama, to be elected to the United States Senate at the age of 40. Growing up, sweeping the floor at my dad's hardware store and cleaning the bathroom at my mom's dance studio, I never could have imagined what my story would entail. To think about what the American dream can do across just one generation, in just one lifetime, it's truly breathtaking. But right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare for so many families. The true, unvarnished state of our union begins and ends with this. Our families are hurting. Our country can do better. And you don't have to look any further than the crisis at our southern border to see it. President Biden inherited the most secure border of all time. But minutes after taking office, he suspended all deportations, he halted construction of the border wall, and he announced a plan to give amnesty to millions. We know that President Biden didn't just create this border crisis. He invited it with 94 executive actions in his first 100 days. When I took office, I took a different approach. I traveled to the Del Rio sector of Texas. That's where I spoke to a woman who shared her story with me. She had been sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12. She told me not just that she was raped every day, but how many times a day she was raped. The cartels put her on a mattress in a shoebox of a room, and they sent men through that door over and over again for hours and hours on end. We wouldn't be okay with this happening in a third world country. This is the United States of America, and it is past time, in my opinion, that we start acting like it. President Biden's border policies are a disgrace. This crisis is despicable, and the truth is, it is almost entirely preventable. From fentanyl poisonings to horrific murders, there are empty chairs tonight at kitchen tables just like this one because of President Biden's senseless border policies. Just think about Lake and Riley. In my neighboring state of Georgia, this beautiful 22-year-old nursing student went out on a jog one morning, but she never got the opportunity to return home. She was brutally murdered by one of the millions of illegal border crossers President Biden chose to release into our homeland. Y'all, as a mom, I can't quit thinking about this. I mean, this could have been my daughter. This could have been yours. And tonight,